Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with Ernest Sosa about the nature and limits of human knowledge. The world is in the midst of a discussion about the nature of truth and knowledge. We may not recognize it at first because it's buried under snark and partisanship and disbelief. But Donald Trump's presidency has forced all of us to become philosophers. Whether we like it or not, we have to evaluate the meaning of alternative facts and make sense of irrational distortions like referring to slaves as immigrants. But the presidential challenge to our theories of knowledge goes deeper than just determining the truth of politicians' statements. The new administration is undermining the role our own senses play in acquiring knowledge. We see a picture of a half-filled National Mall, and our president tells us that it was the most attended inauguration in history. We hear a downpour, yet he insists that the rain stopped when he spoke. Which do we trust, the voice of authority or our own sense perception? It isn't enough to dismiss these claims as the utterances of a pathological liar. They are, like it or not, the foundation of his presidency. And with that, they become the filter through which we will evaluate policy, diplomacy, and political participation for the next 4 years. If we get into a war with Iran, if the Dow Jones surpasses 21,000, if we deport millions of people, it will be in part because it didn't rain on Donald Trump, even though it did. This focus on knowledge marks a sea change. For decades, the linchpin of American political discourse has been conviction, not truth. We've asked whether candidates believe that abortion is murder or that climate change is real. We did not ask what they knew. We voted based on our shared values, whose beliefs about right and wrong most resembled ours, but not on our knowledge held in common. Our candidates shared our worldviews. We never asked if they shared our facts. What does it mean to know something, and how do we know when we know? These are the two most central questions in the history of philosophy, from Protagoras' claim that man is the measure of all things, to John Locke's assertion that human beings are born as blank slates, to Wittgenstein's enigmatic aphorism, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Philosophers have labored to identify what makes human knowledge reliable and what benchmark we can use to justify our faith in our own understanding. I don't want to say we've all failed. Instead, I just observe that the conversation is ongoing. And in the absence of a consensus, it becomes harder to look at President Trump and say, not that he lies or not that he's a propagandist, but rather that he doesn't know. Without a coherent theory of knowledge, it's impossible to have a theory of ignorance. It is with this political background that today's episode will delve into epistemology, the philosophical exploration of the nature and limits of knowledge. Our guest, Ernest Sosa, will take us on a journey through dreams to moral assertions. He will claim, as we shall see, that knowledge is more of an activity than an acceptance of facts. He will suggest that we understand epistemology in terms of virtue, in terms of human excellence, rather than simply intelligence or background information. This is important because identifying fake news and dubious scientific claims isn't about being smart or dumb, but rather about being able, competent, and reflective. It should come as no surprise that some of the smartest people in history believed some of the stupidest things. Partisan comments make it easy for us to dismiss those with whom we disagree. We can reject their beliefs. We can even call them dumb. But doing so leaves us with only three options: to change their mind, to change ours, or to agree to disagree. Instead, if we raise the conversation to the meta level and ask not what beliefs we each should act on, but rather what it means to have justified knowledge in the first place, then we have a more powerful target to aim at. When we develop a standard for right and wrong instead of a list of approved behaviors, we have more than agreement. We have reliability and certainty. It is unlikely that this will lead to consensus, but it will give us the criteria to evaluate which claims are worth our time. If we know what knowledge means, we reduce our choices for disagreement. And when we do that, at least we know that when we argue, we are arguing about the right things. And now our guest, Ernest Sosa is the Board of Governors Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University. He's the author of several books, including Of Virtue Epistemology and Judgment and Agency. Ernie, thanks for joining us on Why.
Thank you, Jack. Delighted to be here.
We've pre-recorded the show, so we won't be taking any questions. But if you'd like to send us your comments, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post a comment on facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or visit our live chat room at whyradioshow.org. So, Ernie, your books often start in a very familiar place. You're asking us to consider how we know we aren't dreaming. Descartes asked this question, even the movies The Matrix did, The Waking Life, lots of different sitcoms. It's also one of those topics that people always imagine philosophers discussing. So I want to start by asking, why are dreams so interesting, and why do they play such an important role in the history of philosophy?
Okay, so epistemology is what I'll be focusing on. So the place of dreams in epistemology is the question and the importance of them. And to lead up to that question, it's helpful, I think, to consider how we gain knowledge in everyday life. I mean, the show is about philosophical questions concerning everyday life, including not only politics, but also just our ordinary gathering of information, acquiring of knowledge. And much of it in our society, advanced technological society, is through gauges. Gauges of various sorts, thermometers, altimeters, speedometers. So how does that happen? Focus on the case of speedometers. We look at the gauge. We perceive the reading. We know the reading. And on that basis, we make a judgment about the subject matter that the meter is giving us access to. So the speedometer reads 60, and we believe our speed to be 60. Now, in order for that to work and to give us knowledge, certain conditions have to be met. I mean, it has to be the case that the gauge is working properly. It's not defective. It's operative. It's also connected properly to the subject matter, to the matter about which we're trying to acquire our information or knowledge. So the speedometer has to be connected to the wheels. Given that those conditions are satisfied, we acquire our information about our present speed. Now, if the speedometer is stuck at 60, then even if our speed is 60, and we believe that our speed is 60 on a good reason, for a good reason, with the speedometer reading is a good reason, we have no reason to suspect that the needle is stuck. Though we get this true belief that's well-based, it is not a case of knowledge. Why is that? Well, if the speed had been other than 60, we would still have believed it was 60. So the reading is not sensitive to the facts that it needs to be sensitive to in order to provide us with knowledge. So even though it provides us with belief, the belief is well-based, has a good reason for it, it doesn't give us knowledge because there's this fact that it's not sensitive. The reading is not sensitive to the facts that it needs to be sensitive to in order to give us this knowledge.
Ernie, if you don't mind me interrupting for a second, then
sure.
Part of what you're suggesting is that when we talk about knowledge, sort of in everyday life, we think about facts. We think about, you know, what's the capital of Arkansas or who was the 15th president. But when philosophers talk about knowledge, they're talking about a wider range of things, from how fast we're going to that a hot stove will burn your fingers, right? So knowledge mm-hmm. is a huge category here.
Indeed. Indeed. So there are all kinds of knowledge. And so there are all kinds of ways of gaining access to the facts about which we have this knowledge. One large category in ordinary life in a technological society is facts that we can gain access to through these gauges. That's a huge set of facts that we rely on all the time. If we do agree that there is this condition of sensitivity, that in order for the gauge to provide us with this knowledge, it has to be the case that it's sensitive to the relevant facts, to the relevant domain. And what that means is simply if the fact had been different, the gauge reading would have been different. If that's not the case, then it's not going to give us knowledge. It's going to give us belief that's true, perhaps accidentally, by luck, but not knowledge. Now, if that's the case, then it becomes very difficult to respond to a skeptic who says, well, you could have been having the same subjective experience that you're having through your hearing, your sight, your sense of touch. You could have been having all of that experience, and it might have been giving you true beliefs about your surroundings in the way the speedometer that stuck gives you a true belief. But it would not be giving you knowledge of your surroundings if all of this subjective experience fails to be sensitive. So just as a gauge, like the speedometer, can be insensitive to a fact about which it gives you its deliverances, so your subjective experience can be insensitive to your surroundings when it gives you its deliverances. So if we say, well, just as with the speedometer now, in order for our sensory experience, our perceptual experience, to give us knowledge of our surroundings, has to be the case that if the surroundings had been different, the experience would have been different. And now, how can we trust that our experience is sensitive to our surroundings if there are many possibilities for things to have gone wrong? How do we know that they haven't gone wrong?
Okay, so to backtrack just a little bit, our knowledge is a sort of a triangulation of both the equipment that we rely on to give us information, but that and also our senses and our mm-hmm. our feelings mm-hmm. and our thoughts and our smells and touches. And I guess if I'm going to anticipate where you're going with this, all of those things are present in dreams, at least as we understand them.
Yes, that's the assumption that we almost universally rely on. That these subjective experiences are present not only when we're actually perceiving our surroundings through the use of our senses, but also when we are, say, hallucinating, perhaps through the use of drugs, or when we're dreaming. That subjective experience can be fully present in those cases as well. And so we face the issue of how we can tell that the sensitive experience that we're having right now as we do perceive our surroundings is sensitive to our surroundings and is not of the wayward sort where we're dreaming or we're hallucinating or in any case we're detached from our surroundings so that the experience, the sensory experience, is not sensitive to the surroundings. How can we know that assumption to be true? And if we do insist on the sensitivity condition, where that means if the subject matter had been different, then the appearance would have been different. If the reality had been different, then the appearance would have been different. If we rely on that, then it's not going to be possible to refute the skeptic who says, well, how do you know that your experience is not deceitful, that it's not illusory, that is not misleading you? Consider that proposition that your experience right now, your sensory experience, is misleading, illusory. And now suppose it had not, suppose the reality, the presumptive reality, the assumed reality that you base on your experience, belief about which you base on your experience, suppose it had been different. And suppose you had been deceived. Okay, so we're going to begin with the assumption we're not deceived. We're actually getting at reality through our senses.
You're saying something that I think the listeners are going to be both really intrigued by and want to hear a little bit more about, which is you keep suggesting that we are assuming that this is our world, that you're assuming that our experiences are accurate. Why do we talk about this in terms of assumption as opposed to – you know, this is where we are. This is our experience. We exist in the world. We don't have to assume that there's a wall in front of me, or we don't have to assume that my smell is
good
accurate.
Point. I stand corrected. Assumption is misleading. I should really speak rather in terms of maybe presumption, appropriate presumption, appropriate just conviction. So we have the conviction that things are fine and that our present experience is sensitive to our surroundings. It's just a background conviction that we take for granted. So there are these takings for granted when we walk down a street that we're in touch with our surroundings through our senses. We take that for granted, and so we take for granted that our senses are not misleading us, that they're not insensitive to the surroundings that we are in touch with.
I think what I'm trying to ask is, philosophers are going to approach things that we, as you say, take for granted, that we presume to be mm-hmm. true, as if they might not be true. And this is not a normal experience for everyday people. So is this presumption that we're not true a special category for philosophers? Can you walk around thinking that this might not be true? Is it a thought experiment? What invites a person to look around and say, you know what? You think you know this experience, but you are just presuming it to be true. There is not necessarily a definitive reason for it to be true. I'm really interested, and I think our listeners will be really interested, in the step that you're taking to be skeptical, not in the Humean sense of skepticism, but to be skeptical of this requires more explanation.
Yeah, so I did not mean to suggest that people normally would question or find it sensible or appropriate to question these convictions that they walk with down that street, or these takings for granted that they do take for granted as they go down the street. So there's no suggestion that they might find that easy to suppose, that they might be wrong, or that they lack any conviction. They might have full conviction, background conviction, but there's still a question that arises, because as we saw in terms of the speedometer, if those senses and the deliverances that they deliver to the subject are detached so that they're not sensitive to the surroundings, then despite the conviction, the background conviction, that the senses are in touch and sensitive to the surroundings, there's going to be an epistemological problem, just as there is with the speedometer. There again, we might have the conviction, the background conviction, speedometer is working fine. It might be, though, that by chance, it's now stuck, the needle is stuck. Then if we believe that the speed is 60, and we're even right in believing the speed is 60, we're not going to know that that's our speed if we're trusting that stuck needle. So the question, now we needn't have any lack of conviction. We may not find it sensible if there's no reason to question the speedometer or the reliability of the speedometer. Nevertheless, we're going to lack knowledge because of the insensitivity of that speedometer with a stuck needle. Now, similarly, with regard to the senses, they need to be sensitive when we walk down that street in order to deliver to us not just belief, but knowledge about our surroundings. And so we have this background conviction that they are being sensitive. Now, that's the theory that we derive from the speedometer. I'm not necessarily asserting that that's the case. It's just that it's a very plausible thing to think when you consider the case of the speedometer and you generalize now to the senses, which are serving as our gauges to our surroundings.
So when we walk down the street and we see a manhole, we walk around it because we assume that it's an accurate
exactly.
gauge. And when we see a truck speeding forward to us, we get out of the way because we assume it's a gauge. And so the senses play the same role
exactly.
in our minute-to-minute experience that the speedometer would do. And I guess I would imagine we'd be just as shocked
yes.
if there wasn't a manhole than if the police officer stopped us and said, you might have thought you were going 60, but you were really going 95.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So now, what the what the skeptic presses now, he makes use of this, these thoughts deriving from the speedometer, applied now to the senses, and the skeptic reasons, well, how do you know? Suppose your senses are reliable, as they are for you and me and our listeners right now. Suppose they are reliable. How do you know that they are not misleading, that they're not insensitive the way the stuck needle is insensitive? If we insist on the sensitivity condition, here's a fact, the fact that the senses are sensitive. And now we have this conviction, this background conviction, this taking for granted that our senses are sensitive, that they're not misleading. But consider that fact. If that fact had not been the case, if we had been in a situation of a stuck needle or a hallucination situation, if we had been in a situation where the senses were not delivering sensitively to our surroundings, would we have believed anything different? Would we not have believed still that the senses were reliable? I mean, if the misleading situation is misleading enough, as in the case of the speedometer, we're going to continue believing that the senses are sensitive, that they're reliable, even when they're not. So if they were not reliable, we would not stop believing that they were reliable. So that very conviction is insensitive, because sensitivity is defined as if the reality were not the same, then the appearance would not be the same.
So are you suggesting that human beings have a predisposition to, I guess, resist the challenge of skepticism, that we operate, since we operate automatically on the assumption that our senses are going to be accurate,
yes,
that any suggestion that we're going to be wrong is just almost, I know you're not making this claim, but almost evolutionarily,
yes,
resisted.
Yes.
So, and if that's the case, then the project of epistemology, the project of knowing what we know, is already skewed, because we are going to defer to the notion that we are right without, unless we have really strong evidence that we might,
exactly,
be wrong.
Exactly. And you know, we can imagine many situations. The skeptics are prolific in proposing skeptical scenarios. There are famous ones from history. The most striking, maybe, to a contemporary audience would be the brain in a vat, a brain in a vat of nutrients, where the sensory experience of that subject whose brain is invaded could be indistinguishable from the ordinary sort of experience that we are having right now.
So the historical example of the brain in the vat is that we think we have a body, we think we're having these experiences, but we're really just this brain that's connected to all these electrodes or what have,
mm-hmm,
you. And even our body is imagined. Even our senses are imagined.
Exactly.
And so this is a thought experiment that philosophers have used throughout history, mm-hmm, to sort of ask, well, look, what if not only, you know, the conviction that your spouse is faithful is imagined, or that God exists is imagined. What if the heat that you feel is imagined? What if the sight that you see is imagined? That the notion of a brain in the vat is a way of controlling the question. And I want to get back to that in just a second, but we do have to take a break. You're listening to Ernest Sosa and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with Ernest Sosa about epistemology and about the relationship between human excellence and knowledge and ultimately virtues and epistemology. So before we get back right into the conversation, a lot of this made me think of something that happened with my daughter quite a few years ago. She was probably about 3 or 4, and we used to watch this movie, actually a little more mature probably than it should have been, but she loved it. It was a cartoon called The Triplets of Belleville. It was a French-Canadian film about a cyclist and really, really interesting this singing group, and she loved it. And one of the main characters is this dog named Bruno, and he's featured a lot in the film, and he's sort of comic relief, and you know, she's a kid and she loves the dog, and we have a dog, and so then one Thanksgiving we tell her that our friend Bruno is coming for Thanksgiving, and she is absolutely convinced that the dog is coming to Thanksgiving, that in her mind Bruno, the cartoon, is real, and that he's really coming to our holiday celebration. And eventually we figured it out, and we told her, no, it's not the dog. The dog isn't real. It's our friend Bruno, who's, you know, a professor at the University of Minnesota. And she seemed both disappointed and relieved at the same time because, of course, she wanted to meet Bruno the dog. The point of the story, of course, is that it becomes easy as a kid to mistake reality and fiction, especially when you spend a lot of time really experiencing a film wholeheartedly with your entire conviction. And I guess the fundamental question of epistemology is, at what point do you get to that intellectual maturity to know the difference, and then is it useful to step back? So Ernie, getting back to the conversation, the brain in the vat that you discovered, that you mentioned, and historically this thought experiment that philosophers used, is that in a sense trying to recreate the experience that my daughter had as a little kid, which is the world is going to be not necessarily real, but what you experience. And so what you think about knowledge, right? Bruno is a dog. That's true in the context of the experience, but it's not necessarily true in the context of the world. Can we use the word true in that context, and can we use the word knowledge when we're talking about, I know Bruno is a dog, even if Bruno is only a dog in a cartoon?
Yes, there's the issue of the detachment between the world of your thought and the world of reality beyond your thought and your experience. And once we have that distinction, then we get the possibility of a mismatch or a lack of sensitivity, just as you do between the world of gauge readings and the world of the realities that those gauge readings give you access to. And so if we say in order to gain real access, knowledge of the reality beyond, we need a certain relationship between the reality and the appearance, whether it be the appearance of gauge deliverances or the appearance of sensory experiences. We need a connection between the reality and the appearance, and very plausibly, then it seemed the connection needs to be that the appearance needs to be sensitive to the reality in such a way that if the reality were different, then the appearance would be correspondingly different. And if there isn't that relationship, then no amount of appearance is going to give you real knowledge of the reality beyond. But then the skeptic enters and says, well, how do you know that you've got that connection? How do you know, for example, that you're not right now a brain in a vat, where your appearances are deriving from electrodes and not from light and sound outside of you? The sensitivity condition enables the skeptic now to make a powerful case as follows. If the connection were not there, you'd still believe that it was there. That is, if in fact right now you were a brain in a vat, having those experiences coming from electrodes, you'd still believe that you were connected to reality beyond in just the way you and I believe right now, have the conviction, the background taken for granted, that we are connected properly, sensitively to our surroundings. So that very assumption is one that we cannot know if we insist on the sensitivity condition, because that very assumption that we're connected, that we're sensitive, if it were false, we wouldn't change our belief. The appearance would not change. So we don't have access to that, to the truth of that conviction.
So going all the way back to the initial question about dreams, I guess if I understand what you're saying correctly, we gauge whether we are right or wrong, whether our beliefs are true or false, based on the information around us, the gauges, our senses, et cetera. And so in a dream, all of the information is created for us by our mind. And so all of the benchmarks we have for testing whether something is true or not is in this closed system. And so we can't step out of it. And since we can't step out of it, we can never know whether something is true or not. Do you think that this is and I know that this is really out of your area of expertise, but is this similar in some sense to, let's say, narcissism? That a narcissist has all of these mental structures and beliefs and habits to think, I am the best, I am the greatest, I am always right. And so when something happens against them, he or she will say, well, I'm experiencing this wrong. It really was in favor of me. I'm going to change the scenario. Is something like narcissism or even some sort of more serious mental illnesses, are they ways of having this closed system as well? And so the knowledge problem of the brain in the vat and the knowledge problem of the dream is also the knowledge problem of mental illness?
Absolutely. There's a very, very close analogy. I mean, the narcissist loses sensitivity to many facts that are very important, social facts. And he loses the sensitivity to those facts because of this illness in a way that he has that doesn't enable him properly to respond to the world around him with appropriate appearances. That is, things get filtered through the narcissism so that the appearances don't correspond to reality in a sensitive way. Reality could be any which way, and he's always going to interpret it favorably to himself just because of the narcissistic filter. So you have the same lack of sensitivity here that you do in the more fundamental case of sensory experience and our physical surroundings. And so you have lack of knowledge in both cases. Now we're interpreting and explaining that lack of knowledge in a certain way that's very favorable to the skeptic. We're interpreting it in both cases, the narcissist case and the sensory experience brain in that case, in such a way that in order for you to be properly related through your appearances to the reality beyond, it's got to be that your appearances are sensitive to the reality in such a way that if the reality were different, your appearances would be different. But then the very fact that we're assuming, that we're taking for granted, that our appearances are sensitive to our surroundings and are not misleading, that very fact is one to which we don't have sensitive access. Because if that very fact had been different, if our appearances had been misleading, we would still have believed that the appearances were not misleading. So we don't have access to that. So how can we know? How can we give a proper standing to our conviction that our appearances are sensitive as we walk down the street?
And in a moment, I'm going to follow up on that question because I want to ask you about virtue epistemology and how we get out of that trap. But it seems to me what you're saying, and I'm thinking of President Trump here, but I promised you off the mic that we weren't going to talk politics. Right. I'm not asking you to respond in any way. Yeah. But it seems to me that if you are a narcissist, it's significantly easier to be a narcissist if you're extremely wealthy, because when you think the world is different than it is, you've got all of these people, all these servants, all these bankers, these yachts and these other places that can make the world respond as if you were accurate. And so part of the problem, it would seem, of being really wealthy and being a narcissist is that you have enough money to make the world operate as if you were right, as opposed to the rest of us who have to deal with lots of people and don't have a lot of money, who are constantly faced with the fact that we aren't right and we have to adjust our system.
Yes, there's that fact, and there's also another fact that is very relevant, which is wealthy, powerful people are often surrounded by yes men or yes women.
Right.
And the relevant facts here are very often social. to which we have access only with the cooperation of our social fellows. And so if they're not going to be giving you the sensitive information, sensitive to the reality.
So other people are our gauges as well,
indeed.
Right? Not just our senses.
Indeed. Yes.
And if the gauges aren't working well, if I say something stupid and everyone around me says, "Oh, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. What a brilliant idea," then it's going to completely corrupt my gauge and I'm not going to be able to respond. And this is incredibly interesting because it helps us explain socially mm-hmm. why some people are detached from reality, and that being detached from reality, right, in this sense, in at least as I am suggesting President Trump is really an epistemological problem. It's a problem of not having the proper gauges, as mm-hmm. you say, not having the proper benchmarks, not having the correcting mechanism mm-hmm. of people, of experience, of, you know, I think everybody should eat healthy food, and I only have $5, so all I can do is go to McDonald's. Right? Mm-hmm. If I'm poor, mm-hmm. that's my reality. Yeah. If I'm Gwyneth Paltrow, a celebrity who's famously talking about this sort of thing, and I have $10 million in the bank, and I say, "Whoa, why can't you eat organic food all of the time?" Mm-hmm. All of my experience, all of my friends, all of my people. They say, "I don't know, right? I can get organic food real easy. I just mm-hmm. sent out my personal assistant yep. to get it."
Yep.
And so epistemology then becomes, at least in this instance, a really practical way of looking at someone and saying, the reason why you get to continue to act the way you do is that all of the things around you, the gauges that you use to give you information about reality are adjusted and distorted to, for lack of a better metaphor, meet your frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these things confirm your presuppositions mm-hmm. as opposed to giving you that critical lens that helps you see better and have a more mature sense of what's really going on.
Indeed.
So then the problem, it seems to me, right, is the question, how do we do this? How do we become better at knowing? How do we refine our gauges? How do we recalibrate things? And this goes back to the central question of some of your work, particularly the area that you're calling virtue epistemology. How do we – first of all, why do you use the word virtue, and how do we use this to improve our actual knowledge?
Right. well, it's virtue, not in a moral sense, which is the more usual, though that's not excluded, but virtue in a broader sense of competence. With epistemology, the objective is getting at the truth, getting access to the relevant reality you're wondering about or that you need access to. Getting at the truth, and so to get at the truth, you need face the relevant questions about that reality, about that subject matter, and you face a question, and then you have choices. You can either affirm, you can deny, you can say yes, you can say no, or you can feel not sufficiently in a position to make a judgment, and so you suspend judgment. And now, to do that well, to make those choices well, you need a competence, that is, an ability to reliably enough succeed in your objective being getting it right on the relevant question. These competences come in a huge variety, even when we're restricting ourselves to epistemology. Because, as we were saying earlier, there are so many different domains of truths or facts that we would need access to and that we would like access to. And so they are competences of a corresponding variety. There are going to be perceptual competences through your senses, your vision, your hearing, and so on. There are going to be the competences of Sherlock, as he figures out who's guilty.
Sherlock Holmes, you mean?
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes, right.
Yeah.
Figures out who's guilty, and that goes well beyond just the perceptual access. He uses the perceptual access, but then he reasons beyond those in various ways. so as to gain access to further facts that he's not then perceiving. And testimony comes in, as we were saying earlier, so we rely on others here for much of the information, especially in a university setting or in a school setting, but in ordinary life all the time as well, through the various media. And we could get into that issue.
And just to interject, yeah. We often do get into that issue because we talk about the social network bubble, right? We talk mm-hmm. about the people who post on your Facebook page who only present the same opinion as you. And so the Hillary Clinton supporters were shocked that so many people voted for Donald Trump because they didn't know anybody who was going to vote for Donald Trump. And the Donald Trump supporters were shocked that anyone was voting for Hillary because they didn't know anyone. And so it's all really the same problem, the same dream problem, brain in the vat problem, narcissism problem, which is this critical lens. And so I'm sorry, please continue.
No, and that I think, in fact, that's I find that a very persuasive, very powerful argument for democracy, which is that in order to gain epistemic access to facts that are important to us collectively, we need to listen to each other and not just to a selective group that's exactly like us. Otherwise, we're not going to get the relevant facts that are so important to arriving at a reasonable, collectively acceptable decision. And so when we become polarized, what happens is each of the sides, each of the poles, loses sensitivity to the relevant facts, the facts that are crucial for arriving at reasonable, collectively acceptable decisions, political decisions. So it's a very troublesome, worrisome development, which is epistemological at bottom. That is, each side, each pole is losing sensitivity to very important facts that are needed collectively.
And to use a much more risque example for folks who maybe don't care that much about politics, it seems to me that you're also making the case for why a person should never fake an orgasm. Right? Because if you don't give your sexual partner the clues as to what they're doing mm-hmm. wrong, mm-hmm. they're never going to change. And so you're creating, again, this narcissistic bubble, mm-hmm. right? In the sense that the person thinks they're great in bed and thinks you're having a good time, and then you fake it and they say, oh, well, I'm going to keep doing it that mm-hmm. way. Yep. And so the person who fakes an orgasm is, in the long term, their own worst enemy if what they want out of this is sexual pleasure for themselves and not just to make the other person feel more competent.
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, so this applies whenever there's social interaction. It could be at the level of a nation and its political life, but it could be social interaction between partners in a marriage.
So is there – I'm trying to think of the right way to ask this. This isn't a completely ridiculous question. Is there any arena, any sphere, any experience, any human interaction that isn't at core based on epistemological realities? And what I mean by that is epistemology seems so foundational given how you're describing it. Is there any way or any circumstance where a philosopher isn't going to be able to come in and say, wait, part of what we're dealing with here is the problem of knowledge. You think you know something and you don't. Your feedback is skewed. Is epistemology really, truly the foundation of the human experience, or is it more compartmentalized than perhaps this conversation is suggesting?
Well, it's foundational for a lot of what makes life worth living. If you think about it, a lot of our reactions to other people in our life together depend on our interpretation of their attitudes, their actions, that's going to go well if those interpretations are correct. If they're totally insensitive and you're just seeing what you want to see, the interaction is not going to go well. The social setting is not going to be, it's not going to be a flourishing setting. We need, and even detaching from other people, even for ourselves. And Robinson Crusoe would still need to know in order to flourish properly. I mean, he could luck out temporarily, occasionally, but if he bases his actions and his plans on knowledge, that's bound to redound to his benefit.
So I'm also thinking of the relationship between knowledge and action. And historically, philosophers have used fairly old-fashioned language to talk about this part of the mind called the will, right? Mm-hmm. Plato
yes.
divides the soul into these components, the will, the intellect, the passions. And we used, you know, everything up through the triumph of the will, right? What's the relationship between knowledge and action? And I don't mean in terms of we judge things based on information, but can we still talk about this human capacity called the will, and does knowledge help us control when we act and when we don't act? What's the connection between our purely mental experience and when we choose to move about in the world? Does the concept of the will, a component of the mind that is responsible for action, that is responsible for our self-discipline and responsible for our moderation and responsible for our persistence, does this still make sense? And if so, how does it connect to the modern discussion of epistemology?
Right. Well, in recent decades, for quite a while back, people have tended to detach knowledge from the will, because people have tended to focus on the kind of knowledge that is constituted by our beliefs that are operative in guiding our behavior. So they're often, these beliefs are highly implicit, and they often guide our behavior without need of explicit consideration, explicit conscious thought. So this goes back, of course, to Freud, but psychology in general works with the notion of belief that is functional that way. So belief works together with desire to lead to behavior. And the quality of the belief matters to the success of that behavior, of that action. And so that kind of belief is largely a functional belief, where the will doesn't enter because you don't need to decide how you're going to judge.
I'm not really sure I understand what you mean by functional belief.
It's just belief that has the function of enabling you to succeed. So it's evolutionarily based,
I see.
Largely a lot of it. And it has the function of enabling you to succeed with your behavior in giving you what you need for a life that so much as survives, but also a life that flourishes. So it needs to work together with your desires, these beliefs, so as to enable you to succeed when you have certain aims in your daily behavior. It could be physical aims, basic aims. And so those beliefs, you don't need to be thinking about them. You don't need to think whether you should put your next foot, whether you should skip with your right foot again or should put your left foot as you walk down that street. Your beliefs that are functional just guide you perfectly well on how to succeed with that walk. So a lot of it is like that, but there's a longer tradition about belief that focuses more on the beliefs that are more operative on the political scene, actually, getting back to that. So these are beliefs where we do decide and where the will does seem to have a place, where you do face a question explicitly, consciously, and in conversation with others. And then you finally are maybe, if you're lucky, if you do well, in a position to say, yes, that's how it is. And your question is then answered, and you're trying, of course, to get it right. And so your objective is getting it right. But when you affirm that is your objective, is you affirm the truth to yourself, and then you store that truth to others, if it's political dialogue or other kinds of dialogue. And so in those kinds of beliefs where language is important, conscious consideration and deliberation are important, for those kinds of beliefs, I don't think the will is entirely or even at all foreign to that, because you reach a decision Even in a simple case, say you add a column of numbers, you do it in your head, you come up with an answer, N. You're not ready to affirm yet. It looks like the answer is N. You take out pencil and paper. Now you feel more sure. You're not quite ready. It's important. And so you don't say N is the answer yet. You take out a calculator or friends help. Eventually, at some point, you're going to be able to decide, yes, that is the right answer. And it's a decision. I don't see much difference between that decision and how the will enters into that sort of intellectual decision and how the will enters in a practical decision, whether to raise your hand to ask a question or whatever the practical issue might be. So the will enters in that way, I think, at the core of epistemology, at the core of our intellectual lives. So if that's so, at the core of our intellectual lives is action, because you have an objective, getting it right on a certain question, and you decide when you're ready to take the plunge and say, yes, that is the right answer. It's a decision that derives from the will. It's a choice that you make.
So it seems to me that there's at least two kinds of knowledge, and I'm gonna give you a leading question here. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that there's two kinds of knowledge. There's the kind of knowledge that you take for granted, that you just operate as if it's true, and then there's this knowledge that circles around on itself, that you rethink, that you reevaluate. Is this the division that you refer to in your writing as animal versus reflective knowledge?
It's very, very closely connected with that, indeed.
Well, can you explain what those two categories are for the people who didn't read the book?
Sure. So animal knowledge is a first-order phenomenon where you're not reflecting on your own intellectual activities on the first order. You're just acting intellectually on the first order. So by
first order, you mean it's outward directed. It's directed at something else, not at itself.
There's that. Yeah, indeed. And so that first order knowledge could be functional. It could be judgmental, where the will is involved. Reflective knowledge is where you do now assess your first order action, whether you should take it, on what basis, and how competent you are to take it, the risks, you assess the risks of failure. Now a belief on the first order, a judgment on the first order that is influenced not only by just your first order thoughtless reaction that doesn't need to be reflectively aided, so that would be the animal belief, but a belief that's aided by that kind of reflection from the second order. How competent am I to judge on this question? What kind of evidence do I have? That would be the reflective judgment or belief.
So animal behavior is more, I don't want to say automatic, because I think that doesn't give it the credit that it deserves, but it's something that you almost take for granted, and mm-hmm. that you can just act. What Csikszentmihalyi called the kind of flow. Mm-hmm. But reflective knowledge is when you're engaging in that critical process, thinking about your thinking about revising.
Yes.
I was about to put two tablespoons of chili powder in that recipe, but that seems like a lot. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I should reflect a second on whether I misread the recipe.
Yeah.
Right?
So,
something like that.
Right. So reflective knowledge doesn't have to be about highfalutin issues. Your example is very apt. Reflective knowledge can come in even at very basic actions, in the case of very basic actions.
Is the process of refining animal knowledge different than the process of refining reflective knowledge?
There's a relationship between the two, because the very thing that you believe at the animal level, because you unreflectively take it for granted, because it's not the sort of thing that requires deliberation or consideration, just an ordinary putting your hand out to grasp a handle before you, and you know where the handle is, and you don't need to think about this reflectively. You just put your hand on the handle and open the door. That sort of thing, based in that way on functional beliefs and basic desires to get out of that room, that kind of functional belief can become an object of reflection, as in the case of your chili powder. And so you can now take up more explicitly and deliberatively the question, is that handle, is the door locked? Is that really a handle that I can open, et cetera? And so you can bring it up to the level of reflection. And so the very same object of knowledge that's an object of functional knowledge can now become an object of reflective knowledge once your decision is now willful and deliberative and based on reflection, second-order reflection.
Okay, so I have a remaining question, although it's really in two parts. Mm-hmm. But in order to sort of set up the question, I want to tell another story.
Okay.
This is a story. My best friend listened to the podcast, and she's going to get very excited when I tell the story. It's because it's one of our favorite stories. I'm in grad school. I'm at Boston, and she's also in Boston. And we're mm-hmm. talking on the phone, and she asked me what I did on a particular day. She's living with her husband-to-be at that time. And she asked me what I did, and I said I went shopping. And so she asks, well, what'd you buy? And I told her I bought a shirt. And she asked, what color was the shirt? And I said, I don't know, off green. And she says to me, there's no such color as off green. That's ridiculous. And I said, of course there's a color named off green. She said, well, what is it? I said, I don't know, a washed out army green. And she said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I said, ask Rob, her husband, to be. And I hear her in the background say, Rob, what is the color off green? And in one of the great, most satisfying moments of my life, I hear him say, I don't know, a washed out army green. And it was incredibly satisfying. The point of the story is, in American culture at least, color is a very gendered thing. Boys are not really educated in a vocabulary of subtle colors, whereas girls have a much larger vocabulary and a much more awareness of the difference between pink and salmon and mauve and all other colors that largely look the same to me. I had a shirt at one point that was called Canyon. I don't know what that was. But the question that I have is, as I sort of notated to myself, is do we have a moral obligation to know things? And I guess I tell the story because I want to ask not just about knowing Shakespeare, right? Do we have a moral obligation to learn great literature and art, to learn more, be well-rounded and have a liberal arts education? But do I have a moral obligation to refine my sense of color the way that Gail would have wanted me to refine my sense of color, to really cultivate my epistemological abilities, do I have a moral obligation to recalibrate those gauges so that I'm continually advancing in my capacity? Someone like Aristotle, right, who is one of the original virtue theorists, who the word virtue comes through him, right, mm-hmm. the Greek word arete, mm-hmm. meaning excellence, mm-hmm. right? This notion that have to be excellent people involves also what he called intellectual virtue, mm-hmm. this ability to refine, continually aim for perfectionism, perfection, even if we don't ourselves reach perfection. So do you think, given what you've done and given the importance of these gauges that you describe, do we have a moral obligation to refine our knowledge?
I think we do. But it's an obligation to refine our knowledge on certain issues of moral concern, be they political or of, you know, just personal moral concern. So there are certain cases where you can't just refuse to get involved. You must get involved. And one very important way you must get involved is epistemologically, that is finding out the issue and finding out what's to be said on the two sides of the issue or more. But I don't think that we have, in general, a moral obligation to become intellectually involved. There are many questions that we can leave aside with no problem at all, where it is entirely permissible just to not get involved. There are issues that are just very, very trivial that we don't need to worry about. Now, of course, as people who are intellectually alive and interested, we face issues of choice and wisdom and judgment in deciding where to put our energy. And those are not; those are certainly not silly. I mean, it matters greatly to our intellectual flourishing to judge properly where our capacities lie and where we should put our energies, so as to come out with a desirable result.
I think that's a wonderful place to stop, because one of the points of the show, right, and this episode in particular, is to say, well, here is this other area of intellectual exploration. You as a listener get to decide what exactly you want to spend your time on. Ernie, I wish we had three more hours to talk about this, because this is one of those subjects that you just have to do so much to get to the core questions. But it's been a wonderful and interesting conversation, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be on Why with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Ernest Sosa and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Ernie Sosa about epistemology and what it means to be an excellent knower. Today was an interesting episode, because I think that the audience really got to hear what it meant to be a philosopher in the most academic sense. There was a precision to the language. There was a patience to the discussion. There was a focus on the things that you have to talk about before you talk about other things. If you were paying attention, you will notice that it took probably about two-thirds of the episode to just answer the first question. When we talk about epistemology, this is the kind of patience that we have to have. When we talk about theories of knowledge, this is the kind of focus and attention that we have to cultivate, because it's such an abstract and subtle topic. It's a really difficult thing to talk about, and it's a really difficult thing to describe. If we extend that to our everyday knowledge, if we extend that to the ways that we think about knowing and experiencing, then one of the things that's worth noticing is that we don't pay that kind of attention to everyday life, and we don't pay that kind of attention to even the critical issues in our lives. I'm not saying we should, obviously. We don't want to think deeply about whether that's a truck as the truck comes speeding towards us, right? We don't want to reflect on every single can of beans that we consider buying at the supermarket. At the same time, this ability to think slowly, this ability to step back and take something that you think is either important or simply just interesting, and offer a period of time for just reflecting on all of the nuances and the boundaries and the details, this is how we improve the muscle of our mind. This is how we practice the ability to really think something through when we have to think it through. Epistemology is a hard subject. Philosophy is a hard subject. Our goal in this show is to make it as accessible as possible. This show is one of those shows where the listener is going to have to do as much work as the guest. I'm going to have to ask you, perhaps more so than I have in many episodes in the past, to really work to get to that point where you think as abstractly as our guest. You may not get it the first time around. You may not get it the second time around. That's okay. We'll be with you for the next 5 years, hopefully, and enjoy the process. What does it mean to know, and how do we know what we know, and how do we become better knowers? These are the deepest questions in philosophy. We've been talking about them for 2,500 years. We're not done. We're not going to get it done in one episode. But for me, illustrating the problem and expressing the detail and the focus of how hard it is to talk about, that in itself is an achievement. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.